Hello, welcome to a new episode of Over Morrow's Library, a podcast series for the Center of Contemporary Arts in Geneva. Today, we will insert in the shelves of our library two short and amazing texts of post-apocalyptic non-fiction. It's only recently that we've become accustomed to placing post-apocalyptic literature in the fiction section of the library, but in other moments in history, post-apocalyptic writing was distributed evenly across other categories: current affairs, memoirs, poetry, on occasion, theology. The two books that we will insert today in our library for the day after tomorrow come from one of those moments in history. They both have very much to say about what it feels like to pass through the end of a future and of a certain world. Today we will look at Rutilius Namazianus' De Redito Suo, concerning his return, written in the 20s of the 5th century AD, and at Paulinus of Pella's short book Eucharistikos, Thanksgiving, written in the year 461. They're both poems, and together they give us an image of one of the darkest moments in the history of Western Europe, the 5th century AD. As we will see, Rutilius and Paulinus are the polar opposites as characters and people. Rutilius, the author of De Redito Suo, is a rich landowner from Gaul with a brilliant career in politics in Rome, and most importantly, he is an unrepentant pagan at a time when Christianity had already become state religion in the Roman Empire. On the other hand, the 84 years old Paulinus, who writes the Eucharistikos, is by that point in his life a semi-ascetic pauper who has lost everything life ever gave him: his home, his wealth, and every single member of his family. He lost everything except one thing: an unshakable faith in Jesus Christ. Both of them, however, despite the differences, were equally swept by the events that made of the 5th century AD truly a seculum horribilis. So, let's start by inserting our two authors in their context. And what better way to begin than from a specific place and time? So let us begin by moving to the hot countryside just outside the walls of Rome on the bright summer day of August 24th, 410 AD. Who's been to Rome in summer knows how hot it can become. It can become even difficult to think straight. But imagine having to think straight while just outside the gates there is assembled the full army of the Visigoth king Alaric, ready to launch the final attack through a gap that finally opened in the walls. On that day, 24th of August 410, for the first time in 800 years, the city of Rome was conquered, sacked and devastated. Back at the height of the Roman Empire, Rome had been a city of over a million inhabitants. After the sack, it went down to a few tens of thousands. And over the following centuries, Rome will continue shrinking, down to the size of a village of just a few thousand inhabitants, taking shelter with their animals among the ruins still surviving from antiquity. News of the sack of Rome traveled across the whole Mediterranean region, shocking everybody, even leading Saint Augustine, the bishop of the city of Hippo in Algeria, to write his book The City of God, where he invited his fellow Christians to recognize the fragility of all that is worldly, of the city of man, Rome, and to concentrate, instead of inhabiting, the truly eternal city of God. But despite this Christian detachment from the events, the loss of Rome was felt as a blow even by theologians, Christian theologians like Saint Jerome, who wrote that with his sack, the Visigoth king Alaric had extinguished the bright light of all the world. Rutilius Namazianus was there. He was in Rome during those days, the days of the sack. And we don't know how he managed to survive. And the fact that he was a pagan certainly did not help. Alaric and his Visigoth horde were in the process of converting to Christianity. And Alaric ordered that during the sack, Christian churches be spared and left alone. So his warriors contented themselves instead with devastating the mausoleums of all the Roman emperors and every single pagan temple or shrine that they could find. In this situation, we can imagine that Rutilius suffered a double agony. Not only he was witnessing the collapse of his beloved Rome, we'll see how much he actually loves the city, but he also had just received news that his native lands in Gaul, in France, were at the mercy of another barbarian assault. Rutilius had a visceral passion for the city of Rome, even though, or maybe exactly because, it was not his original homeland. Rutilius dedicates a section of his book, De Reditu Suo, to exalting Rome, who was always capable of accepting all sorts of foreigners and immigrants like himself, and to bestow on them all the right of being a citizen, regardless of their provenance, ethnicity, or religion. He writes, "Out of diverse people, you, Rome, have created one sole country. What was only a world, you have made a city." But as a Roman, Rutilius is essentially also a foreigner. And foreigners tend to have long-lost hometowns to which they have a strange, nostalgic attachment. And sometimes they fantasize about returning. So now that the empire is finally collapsing, Rutilius wants to go back to his estate in southern Gaul, in southern France, and to try to help the people there the best he can. So he bids farewell to his friends in Rome, and with a small troop of companions, he heads to the nearest port. When he gets to the seafront, he tells us in his poem, in a very moving passage, he feels like he can still hear the noise of the streets of Rome, the roaring of the crowds in the circus, the clamor of the theater. But when he turns back to where they came, he can no longer see the city too far. He can only see a clearance in the sky and a strange light in the sky, just above where Rome probably still is. So they're at the port, and they embark on a small fleet of boats heading north. It's winter, almost winter. The sea is dangerously stormy, but they have no alternative to this sea voyage. The roads are far too dangerous. They're traversed by Gothic warbands, and that traveling party wouldn't be able to find any supplies from the burnt-out villages that now lie in ruins along the once-trafficked streets. So they sail by day, and they take harbor by night. Sometimes they stop in a town whose inhabitants haven't yet fled, and one day they even encounter a procession of worshippers of the Egyptian god Osiris, lord of the underworld and of resurrection, who a long time before came from Egypt, together with his mysteries, into syncretic, multi-religious Rome. Rutilius delights in discovering such glimmers of his lost world here and there, sometimes in a surviving town, sometimes in a pagan shrine, sometimes in the villa of a friend who's still living there as if nothing had happened. But the past is, well, the past is past. And when we encounter it along the way, usually it tends to have the shape of ruins. Also, Rutilius walks among the ruins of a city that has been abandoned a few years before, during the wars that saw the final debacle of the Western Roman Empire against the Goths. Weeds have grown all over the walls of the houses and inside the theater. And Rutilius walks silently along the streets, and he writes, "This town served two purposes. From the landward side, it was an armed fort. From the seaward side, it was a beacon light that shone for the sailor. But the years will crumble even stones. The monuments of an earlier age can no longer be recognized. Devouring time has wasted the mighty battlements away. Only traces remain now among the crumbled walls. Under a wide stretch of rubble lie the buried homes. Let us not chafe their human frames dissolve. Here it is how cities too can die." There is little time to reminisce, though. The 5th century is one of those times when history travels so fast that one has to run to keep up with it. So Rutilius and his companions run back to the ships, and they continue their journey northwards. The sea of late autumn, early winter is stormy, so they need to keep very close to the coast. In the journey, they pass close to the islands just west of Tuscany, and from the deck of their ships, they see the horrible passing spectacle of those who have moved to live in the caves that dot the cliffs of these islands. "These are not normal people," tells us Rutilius, "but they are monsters who have taken to hating life." Yes, because there, nestled in the shadow of the caves, like night animals, dirty and disheveled, there lived the first communities of Christian monks. Rutilius hates them with a passion, in the way that you would hate somebody who is the incarnation of evil itself. Yes, at that time there were other terrible characters, Alaric and his Visigoths, for example, but they could have become true Romans, like all the other foreigners. Yes, they burnt the Eternal City, but at least they did it for a life-affirming reason, wealth, honor, a lust for blood. For Rutilius, it's not the barbarians, but the Christian monks who are the true face of evil. They think that there is only one God in the heavens, and that that God wishes for the destruction of the world. So they mortify their body and they renounce to social life as if life itself was a curse. We read in the book. As we advance at sea, Capraia now rears itself. It's an ill-kept isle full of men who shun the light. Their own name for themselves is a Greek one, monachoi, monks, because they wish to dwell alone with no one else to see. They fear fortune's boons as they dread her outrages. Would anyone to escape misery live of his own choice in misery? What silly fanaticism of a distorted brain is it to be unable to endure even blessings because of your terror of ills? Whether these people are like prisoners who demand the appropriate penalty for their deeds, or whether their melancholy hearts are swollen with black bile, I cannot say. And Rutilius continues, upon another encounter of monks, he writes, "Not long ago, a Roman youth met here, among them, a living death. He was of good family, wealthy, and had the best prospects for his marriage. But for some mad reason, he left the ways of mankind, and in superstition he came here to hide. He imagined that sacred things are discovered in a filthy place. He was crueler to himself than even the offended gods. Surely these Christian beliefs are as powerful as the drugs of the witch Circe. In her day, men's bodies were turned into pigs. Now it is their minds that are changed." So the ship of Rutilius' expedition sails forward northwards. The sea is stormy and hostile, but the coast of Gaul is only a few tens of miles away from them. They still have to reach land, and then they will have to find a way to travel by land to the estate of Rutilius. They already suspect, but they don't know yet, that they will find a country as devastated by war as the Italy which they left behind. Gaul was at the time the epicenter of the struggle for power that was emerging after the collapse of the Western Empire. Rutilius and his companions have a difficult journey ahead of them back home, and once they will be home, they will have a few interesting years awaiting them. We know for certain that Rutilius survived the journey, and that he even found the comfort to write his poem about his return. As it was the custom of the time, he probably published one copy of the book and presented it, reading it out loud to a group of friends gathered in his home. But we don't know anything more than this. The poem ends in the sea, just a few days before reaching the coast of southern Gaul. We lost all the other remaining books of this poem, and with them we lost the tale of what happened next, and perhaps also the portrait of what southern France looked like while it was undergoing yet another apocalypse. It's still a miracle that Rutilius' book survived, although it's amputated of a large part of his body. We know today that around 94% of ancient literature has not made it through the centuries to reach us, but that we have irredeemably lost it. So we are lucky to have Rutilius' book, at least what survives. Yes, if it was possible to bargain with history, I would have no hesitations to swap some of the ancient literature that we still have for the rest of Rutilius' poem. It is such a beautiful read. It's stylish, gloomy, sharp in its description, and partisan, fiercely so, throughout. It's proper pagan literature, elegant, alive, and unafraid of the dark. But the god of libraries doesn't give us the chance of bargaining what we have for what we don't have. But this chance of swapping destinies, was not given to Rutilius and his books, but was given to somebody else, of which we still know the story. This person is a writer who told us the story of how he swapped everything, literally everything, for just a glimpse of light in a time when history seemed to close in, to shred a person to bits, as if it was the pages of in a book. This person is the second protagonist of our episode set in the 5th century AD, Paulinus of Pella, the author of the poem Eucharistikos. Let's start with his name, Paulinus. What does it mean? Many of us today still have this, carry a similar name, Paul. Well, it comes from Latin, meaning small, and it's part of one long list of humiliating names or nicknames that were typical of early Christians. Imagine that at the time, people who'd convert to Christianity would often change their name, but change their name in a way as to signal to their humility and humbleness and the recognition of the fragility of the world. So, for example, some people took the name Proiectus, which means scattered away, or even Stercorius, which means literally shitty. He took the name Paulinus, the tiny, tiny one. I said that Rutilius and Paulinus couldn't be more different. But this is true only in part, to be honest. They were both Romans who came from far away. Rutilius was a foreigner from Gaul, Paulinus from Greece. And yet they were both Romans. One was a pagan and the other was a Christian. But at least at the beginning of their lives, they were both members of the upper classes of Roman society. So let us move back to the beginning of Paulinus' life, a life of luxury. In his poem Eucharistikos, Paulinus retells the carefree days of his golden youth, when father was alive and the seams of the empire were still holding together. Life was easy back then. Paulinus' parents moved from Pella in Macedonia, northern Greece, to Gaul, near where Rutilius might have ended his days, and they established there as wealthy landowners. They gave their son the best the world had to offer, a wonderful home, all kinds of entertainment, an army of servants to look after his every need, and even a tutor who could speak both Greek and Latin, and teach him the literature and philosophy in both languages. In his poem, Paulinus is honest about how difficult it was for him to go to school and to learn. His mind could not keep up with the lessons, and especially with dealing with two different languages, Latin and Greek. He writes literally, and I read, "Such polyglot learning is designed for strong minds and decorates those who can do it with a twin radiance. But for those like myself who cannot, its wide range is destructive. Very soon it drained dry the veins of my barren mind." Despite the difficulties at school, however, Paulinus' life in his youth was golden. Golden and dark. And here we get a glimpse of what it was like being a young spoiled brat during the Roman Empire. And I'll read, so you'll see. "I wanted to have a fine horse, bedecked with special trappings. A tall groom, a swift hound, a shapely hawk, a tinsel bowl, fresh brought from Rome, to serve me my games of pitching. To wear the height of fashion and to have each latest novelty perfumed with sweet-smelling myrrh from Arabia. Also, at that time, I felt sexual desires burning in me. After the first excesses, I curbed my will with a simple rule. I would seek no unwilling victim, nor would I injure another or what was probably his. I resolved to avoid affairs with the freeborn, and I contented myself with a love that I could command within our home." So you see here, even for a wannabe Christian like Paulinus, rape among slaves was not really a problematic behavior. Paulinus continues with his story. He tells us that at last he marries and settles down, and he begins to look after the family business, his father's business. But father dies at the same time as Rome is devastated by the Goths. The year is again 410. Paulinus writes, "My inexperience needed my father's counsel, and my maturity needed him for a model. But shortly after my 30th year, the Roman world was struck in its heart by an enemy, and my father died just at the time the empire fell. From that point onwards, everything in Paulino's life goes downhill. He loses everything, one bit at a time. First, his city is attacked by the Goths, led by the king Ataulf, and the city itself is burned to the ground, and Paulino's house is sacked and then destroyed. So Paulino's and his family leave the ruins of their home, and they move to a nearby town, Vazatis. But Vazatis, soon afterwards, is also besieged by the Goths. He writes, "When we were driven from our ancestral home and our house was burned down, straight away siege by the enemy overtook us in the neighboring city of Vazatis. And far more dangerous even than the Goths, there was a conspiracy of slaves armed specially for the slaughter of their masters." You can see here the tensions that are erupting in the 5th century. Religious, political, social. So Paulinus keeps running away, trying to find some place of safety together with his family. He doesn't really want to find a normal life anymore, however. He's realized that the past is completely gone. His real desire is to protect his family, but especially to find salvation for himself. Not the kind of salvation, however, you can find with weapons or wealth. He wants to become a monk, but he has to look after his family. And so he postpones indefinitely this passage until his mother dies. Then soon after, his wife's mother dies. Then his wife dies. Then his two children abandon him, taking away all of his remaining wealth. And then, one after the other, they both die. So Paulinus remains entirely alone in the world, and he decides to move to Marseille, to live in a small house attached to a small allotment. There he lives in complete poverty, and he has to count on the help of his friends from the Christian community to survive. Finally, he finds a Goth, a Visigoth, who wants to buy that piece of land and that home where he lives and give him some money, enough that he can live for the remaining years of his life. Paulinus is grateful. And when he becomes homeless, he starts writing the book, Eucharistikos, Thanksgiving, where he concludes by saying, "When all my expectations of family joy were so violently taken away from me, I discovered, after all had been lost, that we must seek the things we most desire in you, O God, because in you is all power. O Christ, may my fears and doubts be put away by the knowledge that while I live, I am yours, because everything that lives is yours. And when I have died, I will become part of you." Here ends the short poem Eucharistikos by Paulinus of Pella. Both Paulinus and Rutilius, despite their differences, at the end of their adventures managed to reach an invisible world, within but outside the normal world of their time. Rutilius wrote his poem perfectly ancient, down to its style and the very use of grammar. He wrote this poem as a ship that could take him elsewhere, back across time, back to a Rome that was, or perhaps maybe a Rome that never really existed outside of Rutilius' imagination. Paulinus, on the other hand, exchanged everything, even his own fears and regrets, for a little opening in the barrier that separates the world from heaven. In their own way, they both did the only reasonable thing that they could have done at the time when a world was collapsing. They dug among the ruins, looking for a passageway leading elsewhere, outside that world. And even though we leave them here, on their way to the other side, we will continue to stay in the space between worlds, also in the next episode. In the next episode, we will interview poet and scholar of Roman history Francesco Strocchi to talk with him about another moment in Roman history, when the edges of two different worlds were meeting and crashing against each other. So I hope you will follow me to the next episode of Over Morrow's Library, still here from the Center of Contemporary Arts in Geneva. Goodbye.